Welcome to the Reader's Roundtable edition of Cattlecast with Jessica Trotter, Mari Garza, and Cheryl Lindemann.
Welcome, ladies. It's November. We're kind of looking at both end of the year, Native American Heritage Month. It's just great books that we're interested in. This isn't a themed one. This is us enjoying books and wanting and being excited about things we want to share.
Yeah,
is that sort of kind of where we were going this one?
Yeah. Basically, yeah.
And I think I'm going to start off today. And the book that I wanted to start with is The Berry Pickers. Some of you may have heard of this. This just won the Barnes & Noble Discovery Prize. And it's a really interesting, it's a fiction novel by an indigenous writer whose family would migrate back and forth across the border to pick berries in Maine. And this is a story kind of based in that background, but it explores, what it's really about is exploring the difference one bad decision can make on so many lives. It opens with six-year-old Joe. He's the last one to see his sister Ruthie when she just disappears. They're in Maine. They're, you know, kind of grouped around the cabins that they stay in when they're there working. And she had been sitting and he had done something else, and then nobody can find her. It's a loss that changes the family forever. They're still looking for her, but she is not found at the end of the summer, and just life goes on. But it so deeply affects Joe in particular, and you sort of follow his life forward. Meanwhile, you've got Norma, has this very strange and confined life with an overly attentive mother, very apologetic father. She knows she doesn't quite fit into her family, but she doesn't know why. And this is the story. It's a story of trauma. It's a story of hope. And it's a story of kind of really finding truth. And so it's a hard one, but it's really well written and well done. And it's a very interesting look at the dynamics between the two families.
That sounds so good.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I can totally see why it was on the radar for that award.
Yeah. And one of the best covers of the year. I always look at the covers.
All those blueberries.
Gorgeous berries on the cover. It's just like you can't help but start to catalog in your head what the best covers of the year are, and that's in my top 10.
Mm. Wow. Well, I will put that on my TBR. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm up next. This is Madi, and I have a picture book called Rock Your Mox, and it's by Laurel Goodluck, illustrated by Madeline Goodnight. And since we are celebrating Native American Heritage Month, I was really drawn to this title because I had never heard of Rock Your Mox Day. But it is a holiday that started in 2011 when Jessica Aitzai, she's from the Laguna Pueblo federally recognized tribe in New Mexico. And she was thinking, like, why do we save our moccasins just for ceremonies and powwows? You know, why not, like, celebrate this more often, our regalia or our moccasins? So she started an initiative for children to wear their moccasins to school or wherever, really. But it's a beautiful picture book. That kind of depicts children from all different tribes because they are all over the country and in Canada. And something that I really liked about it was just the variation in the beadwork that you found.
Very much, yes.
You know, and the different types of materials that are used, like based on where you live, you might use something with fur or a different type of a leather. And then there was also you know, something that was really striking to me was that, you know, something like 70% of Native Americans are not really living necessarily on their tribal lands. Mm-hmm. They're in urban areas, in farm areas, in small towns, like, you know, where we live. And I really like that there was this depiction of, you know, everyday life. Mm-hmm. Children doing ballet, children mm-hmm. skateboarding, children walking to school, sitting with their parents in their homes. It was just a really nice thing to remember that, you know,
they're not gone.
They're not gone, and they're not separate.
It's very unfortunate that the United States tried so hard, but yeah. they are not gone. They are yeah. here and part of the communities, and yes.
Yeah. So, like I said, there's, you know, I don't know, 575 or maybe even close to 600 federally recognized tribes. And, of course, you know, Good Luck or Laurel Good Luck could not feature them all in mm-hmm. the book. But she has like a, I don't want to say a sampling, but something of a like a popcorn nature of like, just here's some representation of the different types of Native tribes that are in North America. And she also has a really nice pronunciation guide in the book. And then at the back is a very good introduction to, again, modern Native American life and children mm-hmm. and how they're living out. So I really want to recommend that book. And hope that you enjoy it with your family.
Mm-hmm. Sounds so good. Cool. That reminds me of a library conference or Michigan Library Association I went to a number of years ago, and there was an Indigenous librarian who spoke, and that was one of her first points is, we are still here. There's even a book, yeah. children's book, yeah. called that, and she's saying so many people still think of yeah. Indigenous yes. or Native Americans yeah. as being in movies or as yeah. a whole, you know, race of people who are gone. And she's like, no, we're clearly still here. And of course, we've seen so much more, so many more books even since I went to that presentation.
Yes,
oh,
yeah. absolutely.
Which I think was like yeah. 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, even thinking about, yeah. you know, I think Tommy Orange made such a splash because, again, people don't think, yeah. You know, there is set in Oakland, California.
Yeah.
But there is this narrative or this myth that yeah. there are no Native Americans, which is yeah. really
not
horrible
true.
And not true.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Well, my next book is also by an Indigenous author. The author is Robin Wall Kimmerer, and you may or may not be familiar with her. She has a book that has probably sold, I think the last number I saw was 2021. It was over 500,000 copies.
Oh, my God, yes.
It's called Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teaching of Plants. And this book has, I would say, gone viral. It was a hand-to-hand,
yes.
word-of-mouth bookseller, librarian-sold mm-hmm. type book, which has gone, you know, all over the world, mm-hmm. been translated. But the book I'm going to talk about today, it's the 10th anniversary, rather, of Braiding Sweetgrass, but this book goes back 10 more years before that. And it didn't have as much notoriety or acclaim, but it was also a hand-sold book at the time. And this is Robin Wall Kimmerer's first book called Gathering Moss, and again, it's 20 years old as of today. It's a natural and cultural history of mosses. And it was the winner of the John Burroughs Medal for Natural History Writing. And this is a fantastic introduction to Robin Wall Kimmerer's work. I read Braiding Sweetgrass first, and it's taken me a while to get to this one, and I'm so glad I did. It is so magical, I would say, her writing. She is an enrolled member, citizen of the Potawatomi Nation, and she is also a plant botanist. When you read her bio, she also says she's a mother, which is very important to her, and that comes through her work as well. And she is a plant scientist at heart. But when she was studying plant science, she kept feeling like there was something really missing. And this is what she gets into a lot in Braiding Sweetgrass, but she also touches on it in this book. And this book, like in Braiding Sweetgrass, she interweaves some narrative, personal narrative, stories of her daughters, these really deep stories, also Indigenous history, in this case, the use of moss with Indigenous cultures. As, you know, stuffings for bed pillows, for, you know, different, it's in the book, a lot of different ways that it's used. But there are 22,000 species of mosses. And what she does in this book is takes you sometimes into quite a bit of technical detail, other times not. It's more of a narrative type essay, but into looking very intimately, often under the microscope with her, at moss. And you realize that this is this incredible species of creatures, basically, who have been here for 400 million years and will probably exist long after other life forms on Earth. And she talks about how essential mosses are to our environment, and each moss is its own little rainforest in and of itself. You can take certain mosses, and they've been put in like cabinets for 40 years, and as long as they can rehydrate, then they will come back to life. So that's one of the little things that you find in this book, and it's just amazing. And it took me out of myself and into something, studying something really intimately and seeing that there's this beautiful, intricate world that goes on completely without humans.
Right.
And in fact, humans usually mess up the situation for mosses more than anything, but that mosses are completely essential to the carbon cycle, to the air that we breathe, to pretty much all of life on Earth. We're sort of leaning on mosses. And she says in the book that if we could model ourselves better after mosses, we would probably make a much better world. So she's learned from the mosses themselves. And a fun little factoid is a moss scientist is a bryologist, which she is one. So gathering moss, I highly encourage you to check this out, or braiding sweetgrass.
Very cool.
Okay. Well, my next title is not quite like moss, in that there's a focus on the outdoors for sure. It's called Gather by Kenneth M. Cato, and he is a debut author. And Gather is a young adult novel. It's about a teenager who's desperately, trying to hold on to a family home and land in rural Vermont. He's also trying to help his mother stay clean of an opioid addiction that she has. First of all, I feel like if I gush a little too long, please just cut me off. But the first thing I noticed about this novel is the voice of the teenager. Ian is a kid who's like maybe in 10th grade or so, 14, 15 years old. And he is just in love with his beautiful woods, with the rivers, with the trails that are around his community, walking over land. He has a French heritage that goes back to like 200 years or so. And unfortunately, his family has lost quite a bit of the acreage of the land that he has on his father's side. But he still has something. They still have a house that's kind of going. Kind of has his problems. And he has, a memory of a grandfather who really instilled in him many values of, valuing the land and valuing the ability to get things done for yourself. So I really think he's someone who's got a lot of grit. He's a very DIY sort of person. And so he likes to fix things. He's very much a tinker. And his neighbors, meanwhile, are all very modern and slightly wealthy. And they've noticed that he does know how to fix things, despite the fact that he looks like he's struggling, like he's poor, like he doesn't have, clothing that fits him. He doesn't have enough food sometimes. And as I mentioned, his mother has some issues. And even though he doesn't really consider himself, I think, to be very academically inclined, I think he has a lot of self-awareness and insight into how the world works. So he notices one time when he's out roaming his beautiful lands that there's these signs posted that, in an area where it was once free to just kind of go out and do whatever, now there are signs posted. And it's not exactly like keep out, but something to that effect. And it really bothers him that people can do this, that his community has these free properties that are now not really free. And he is really just someone who is just wondering, like, why is it that people who are farmers, which is essentially what his family used to be, why they can't make a living? Why is it that all these wealthy people are moving here, moving around? There's a lot more to this book in that there's just a lot of stunning drama that goes through it. But as I said, his voice, I really felt like I was talking to a 15-year-old who is just so incredibly persistent and strong about trying to make a way when it seems like there's nothing for him, because his parents are definitely checked out. His father is distant. And the last thing I'm going to say is there is a dog in this story that is very much a primary character. I don't want to say too much about the dog, but this is a 2023 National Book Award for Young People's Literature nominee. and I really hope you will stick with it. It is such a great book.
It sounds amazing and also a phenomenal cover because yes. the dog is juxtaposed over this gorgeous outdoor scene.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. And it's got sort of like a fall season.
Yeah.
There's a lot of winter in the book, meaning cold and snow and ice. That's also a character, the weather.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Okay, I'm going to jump back to, I'm going to very briefly say about the Berry Pickers. I'm not sure that I said that the author's name is Amanda Peters. Now I'm going to move forward, and this next book is more up maybe than the Amanda Peters, the Berry Pickers, because it is that is a very solidly hard topic when you're talking about a disappearance, a kidnapping, whatever it is in the book, and I didn't say purposely. But the book that I want to talk about next is A Cold Hard Prayer by John Smolens. He's a Michigan author. This is a Michigan book. It's historical, set in the 20s. It features an orphaned mixed-race girl named Mercy. She has this plan. She has been living in an orphanage. She has been grouped with a bunch of children on an orphan train. But she has some prior knowledge. She has somehow figured out, she'd gotten access to a letter from an aunt and uncle who were trying to get her. That the orphanage has ignored. And so she's now on this orphan train, and as they're moving from the Boston area across into the Midwest, she's purposely making herself not adoptable until she makes it to Michigan, at which point she and another child on the, they're teens, another kid on the train are adopted by a Southeast Michigan family. It's a woman with health issues and a man who is okay as long as his wife is around, but otherwise he is prone to drinking. It's not a great situation, and honestly, Mercy has plans to get out of it. She's just looking for a way to figure out how to get to that area where the letter came from her aunt and uncle, which was St. Ignace. So she, again, they're in Southeast Michigan, and her grand plan is to get way up north. Something happens at the farm. She takes off, and the boy who's with her follows her, and it becomes a bit of a chase. There is a crime that happens at the farm. They may or may not be involved in it. You don't really know for a good chunk of the story. There's a police officer that is chasing them, but he's very thoughtful. He really is interested in everybody's sides to the story and wants, whereas you also got a group of people that are trying to take advantage of this. She's mixed race, and the other character is Irish, a Catholic. And so you've got this, and actually she is too. They both come from Catholic, a Catholic orphanage. So you've got a lot of things that the Klan is trying to exploit. And whether or not they actually committed a crime, they don't really care. They just want to use it as a way to build their cause in othering people and creating issues that way. So there's a lot going on in the book. There's a lot of really interesting characters. John Smolens knows Michigan. There's a fair amount that happens on either side of the straits. This is, of course, pre-bridge, so we've got a ferry going back and forth, and it's just there's even a touching on the indigenous schools. It's really kind of interesting, everything that he managed to get cram into this book, and it's very well done. So it's A Cold Hard Prayer by John Smolens.
That sounds really good. Mm-hmm. My next book goes a little bit back to the nature theme, mm-hmm. and this one is, wow, I feel a little bit like Monty did about Gather, about this. I feel a little gushy because this is a book I was really waiting for. I can never turn down a Jerry Pinkney book, and also this book is written by Nikki Grimes. Sadly, Jerry Pinkney did pass away this year, and there were two books posthumously published, and I did talk about one of them earlier in the year, Just Jerry, How Drawing Shaped My Life. So this book is one of those, it's really quite something, the way that the plan for the story and the reality of the story really affecting people in real life sort of come together in this sad, melancholic, but also very beautiful way. So A Walk in the Woods was a book that was planned by Nikki Grimes and Jerry Pinkney, and they've been friends since 1977, but had never collaborated on a book. So they had the plans, they planned this during COVID. He had worked on his characteristic, beautiful line drawings for the work. Nikki Grimes was writing the story. The idea was a story about, based on Jerry Pinkney's walks in his own woods, I believe in upstate New York, but also this idea of a black child experiencing nature, and they really wanted to focus on that in the story. Well, Jerry Pinkney does pass away, and now they're left with, the drawings were done, and she had worked on a lot of this, the story that they were going to write. But they end up writing a story, they end up pulling this together, and Brian Pinkney, Jerry's son, actually uses his own watercolor artworks, which are very similar to his father's artwork and pen and illustration style, and they put this whole thing together after Jerry passes away. But the story itself is about a little boy who's grieving his father, and he gets a little piece, a little letter from his father, and he's like, oh, what is this? I want something more than, it's like almost like a treasure map. And he's set out into the woods, these woods that they walk together all the time. So he sets out in the woods, and he's very upset, and he's a little bit annoyed. He's like, yeah, this is not really what I wanted. I wanted like more, you know, I wanted words or something. He goes out into the woods, and he starts noticing things that they always notice, like the garter snake, which has a name, and deer, and different creatures. And then he goes out to this place. It's a fireplace in the woods, like an old home piece foundation. And he pulls this treasure out of it, which are his father's line drawings that his father had drawn, when his father was a boy. And there's a message with it saying, you know, basically a message of, you know, enduring love, and saying, this last blank page is for you. I'll always be with you, but now you write your own story. So that's really what's the story of this book, but art imitated life, in that Brian Pinkney was then, in some ways, kind of forced to do that real thing to make this book. So it kind of gives you the chills, and it's just beautifully crafted in every way.
It's a very beautiful book.
And it's cool because it's set, the colors really are, it's set in the fall. It's a lot of oranges.
Yeah, very much. Yep.
Nice.
Yep.
So I encourage this book. It'd be really good for family sharing. I think this is one of those books that would have great appeal for adults. Picture books do not have to be just for kids.
Right.
Right.
Just a beautiful book.
I really love the connection between grandparents and grandchildren, fathers and sons. Fathers and daughters, mothers and daughters, mm-hmm. and that's really nice.
Yes, and Jerry Pinkney's, I believe it's his great-granddaughter or granddaughter, is the person who actually digitally pulled the whole thing together.
Whoa.
So there was another generation.
Okay.
I mean, it's just one of those books that's like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. Okay, I'm closing us out. I didn't want to let this go, so I'm going to say, if you like Legends and Lattes, Travis Baldry's next book, Bookshops and Bone Dust, is due out November 7th. It's wonderful. It's a prequel. It's Viv in her early Merc days, so long before she wants to open the coffee shop. But it's still got that same great mix of humor, community building, and action that I loved in Legends and Latte. So just a quick shout out to that one because it's coming out. But the one I really wanted to talk about today is Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of Fairies by Heather Fawcett. This is a really wonderful series starter. It's featuring this curmudgeonly, I think of her as focused and slightly ferocious academic. She's Emily Wilde. She's a dryadologist from the University of Cambridge. She's trying to put the finishing touches on the world's first encyclopedia of fairy lore and attain tenure. So, I mean, she just wants that comfort of getting tenure at Cambridge. So she's in this last steps is her last hurdle is this research trip to the far north. Think north Scandinavian countries. She made it up. It's not Norway particularly, but it's something quite like that. And she hasn't entirely thought it through. She's not quite prepared for how sparse and away the village she's going to stay in is. She also did not plan for the fact that her academic rival slash friend slash, I don't know, she doesn't quite know yet, but friend-ish person, Wendell, is also going to show up out of the blue. And he also has, he has put more thought into the where they're staying, you know, and he has brought some research assistants with them. But she's like, you're just honing in on my, you know, horning in on my research. I don't know why you're here. But they end up needing to work together. There's a lot going on in this community. There's a fair amount going on, but just between the two of them, it's fun. It's dark in its way, because some of the, if you think about fairy lore, whatever, if you know about fairy lore, it can be very dark. And it explores kind of some of the dark sides to it, some of the funny sides to it. There's a lot of really great characters in it. And it's just the start of a series, and following Emily and Wendell around can be really fun.
Yeah, that's cool. Sounds good. Dryad makes me think of Anne of Green Gables. The Dryad's Bubble. Was that the place of the Dryad's Brook? It's one of the
something
locations.
Like that's what she names, yes. Yes.
That's awesome.
So we got great reads here. Pick some. Yeah. Go grab
them. I'm definitely motivated to pick some of these up.
Yeah, awesome.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.